I'm Chris Williamson, former Labour MP and founder of the Resist movement and a presenter of Palestine Declassified on Press TV.
Tell us about this Resist movement, because I know that there's all sorts of groups in the generally on the left. It's almost like the People's Front of Judea, many different organisations. The left doesn't seem to be able to consolidate itself and, politically, like the Tories do, for example.
No, that's been a feature of the left in this country since time immemorial. But the reason why we established Resist was to try to, if you like, be the glue to bring the left together. The thing that we've said right from the outset is that if we are to prosper, that is the left in this country, is to prosper outside the Labour Party, then we've got to collaborate, we've got to work together. And you only need to look to examples from around the world. In Latin America, the most recent example of this working in practice against a US-backed coup, for example, was in Bolivia, where shortly after Evo Morales had won a landslide victory, was ousted at the point of a gun in a US-backed coup. But within 12 months, in fact, less than 12 months, the movement towards socialism in Bolivia had forced new elections because they were embedded in the trade union movement, in civil society, and they brought the country to a standstill, forced new elections, and the socialists came back with an even bigger majority. Just over the channel, actually, in France, Jean-Luc Mélenchon has demonstrated the effectiveness of bringing the left together, as it were. So, we saw the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, and other groups on the left collaborating, and they are now the main opposition. I was hoping that, Mélenchon would become prime minister, but didn't quite make that, but certainly deprived Macron, the neoliberal Macron president, who just won a presidential election, as we know, of the overall majority. So he's not going to now be able to force through the neoliberal reforms that he was hoping to do so, because he needs to get them through the French National Assembly. So that's really where we're at. I mean, we need to try and, bring the left together. I mean, I work with the Workers' Party. Workers' Party have now taken a seat on the Trade Unionist and Socialist Coalition. So, we're still in the early stages, but, things can move quickly. And with this cost of living catastrophe, which is befalling, millions of people in this country, I mean, who knows where we might be this time next year. I'm hopeful, and we have to remain hopeful, that we can bring about a change.
Definitely. we have to keep being hopeful. I think there's a lot of attempts to sort of demoralise people, make them give up on politics and policy. Mm. And that simply is a ruse. But anyway, what do you make of the fascinating success of Gustavo Petro over in Colombia? You mentioned South America, Latin America there, because mm-hmm. this has been really a continent on the front line with US power that is also, of course, being projected into Europe and into Eastern Europe too. But so what do you make of the recent election of Gustavo Petro in Colombia?
Well, it's just the latest example of, the left prospering in Latin America. I think, though, that, I think there's one slight word of caution is that, I mean, I think, they've not demonstrated solidarity. I think they've even been critical of, Venezuela, of Nicaragua. And that's something which I think, needs to be addressed. Maybe they're kind of doing that to perhaps try and avoid, CIA intervention or whatever. But it's significant, I think, that, in Colombia, of all places, that people have had enough. And, for somebody who was a, former rebel, albeit some time ago now, 30 years or so ago, to, come to the fore and, be elected as sort of country's leader, president, I mean, is very significant, I think. And, so that's just the latest example. But, I mean, right across Latin America, the pink tide is sweeping across the continent again. I mean, we saw that in the late 90s, early 2000s. It was pushed back somewhat. Thanks, in large measure to the pernicious influence of the United States. But, in spite of that, the left remained strong, even though they had some successes in, for example, like Ecuador, after Carrera had stepped down after he'd reached his term limit. Unfortunately, his successor, Lenin Moreno, went back on, he was the vice president, actually, but went back on, a lot of the reforms that that Carrera had implemented. But nevertheless, although they kind of pushed back, and I think Moreno did win an election subsequently after kind of reneging on a lot of stuff, the left continued to remain substantial. They weren't kind of, crushed, as it were. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's very encouraging to see that. And, I'm hopeful that, even close to hand. I mean, in places like, Greece, we saw Syriza coming to the fore, and in Spain, Podemos and so on. And now more recently, Jean-Luc Mélenchon's alliance. So, yeah, I think there's a lot to be hopeful about. But the lesson I think that we need to draw from Latin America, from Europe, where the left has made significant progress, it's only by working together, by collaborating. But of course, don't underestimate the role of the state in this country. The security services, we know what they're capable of. We know that they sought to undermine Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. We know that they have infiltrated a range of different groups, environmental groups, left-wing political groups, they establishment in this country thrives on divide and rule. I mean, that's how they sustain their position. And obviously, they want to demoralize people, because a demoralized public is not going to pose any threat to any challenge to the neoliberal status quo, from which the elites in this country substantially benefit.
To what extent do you think, Chris, these state actors, when they are infiltrating groups, and of course they may feel that they've got a legitimate interest in knowing what various groups are up to, but I think most people get much more concerned when they start to begin to, for example, form relationships, sexual relationships, have children with activists, and then even more, maybe on a par as worrying, is when they start to steer those groups. In other words, they get people in there who are actually directing them rather than observing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, but I think in any kind of radical movement, not just in this country, but around the world, that is something that the state does, the vested interests, in order to sustain the situation that they hugely benefit from, that they do whatever they can to limit the advance of an alternative prospectus. And we've seen that in this country, we're seeing it now, and they will continue to do what they can. What we need to be, though, we need to be as determined, as ruthless as they are. And I think one of the mistakes that Jeremy made was trying to make peace with people who were determined to destroy him, and to destroy, this is Jeremy Corbyn, of course, destroy the project that that he was spearheading. And the ultimate consequence of that was that we lost the election. We saw many, many, many excellent activists, socialists, anti-racist activists thrown under the bus, and then they came for Jeremy. And the lesson surely from that must be that you have to fight back, you have to stand your ground, and you can't make compromises with people who are effectively the kind of inveterate enemies of a socialist progressive alternative, and that includes the Parliamentary Labour Party, and indeed many people, well, virtually all of the bureaucracy of the Labour Party, and a number of people who are embedded in constituencies up and down the country.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've got this RMT strike this week going on, and possibly into the future.
I've been on the picket line this morning.
Of the Labour Party's reaction to that, because they've been kind of fence sitting. One would have thought that if you're standing for the rights of workers, that it is an absolute open goal to be to use like a wet fish to slap the government with, really, but they haven't done that, at least from the leadership. One or two of the members of parliament, Labour MPs and activists, of course, have been supporting the. But what do you make of the actual case that the Rail Maritime Transport Union have been putting for this strike?
Well, I mean, you know, it's entirely justified. But look, the Labour Party doesn't represent the interests of workers. And I'm frankly, I'm astonished that any trade union is still affiliated to the Labour Party when they are actively working against the interests of their members. And it's a forlorn proposition to suggest that, well, somehow they might have some influence. Well, you know, there's no evidence of it whatsoever that the trade unions, which effectively, you know, bankroll the Labour Party, are having any influence at all. I mean, you know, the people that are, you know, calling the shots are, you know, the corporate elites in this country. But look, there's a, you know, there is a cost of living catastrophe in this country. And, you know, what the RMT are doing, and the RMT, let's remember, I think, are the brigade of guards now of the Labour movement. I mean, it used to be the National Union of Mine Workers. I mean, Thatcher saw to it that the NUM were crushed, and obviously the industry, you know, was then totally destroyed. And it's now the RMT, which is, as it were, leading the charge. And I think, you know, the Tories, it's another, you know, set piece battle. I think they're determined, if they can, to destroy, to defeat and destroy and crush the RMT union. And that's why it's so important that the Labour movement, you know, steps up and stands shoulder to shoulder. That's why I was on the picket line with RMT members this morning in Derby. And we, you know, we need to be doing that. We need to support them. And I was encouraged, I've got to say. I mean, I was there from early doors about 6:30 this morning. We were on a main road, the Railway Technical Centre in Derby. Lots of support, actually, from people driving by. So I think I sense, a shift in the zeitgeist. I think people have had enough, frankly, of the nonsense and the ridiculous arguments which have been put about trade unions, you know, so-called greedy trade unions. And look, the only greedy people in this country are, you know, these corporate elites, the financial services industry and so on. These are the characters that are causing inflation in this country. And what we should be demanding, what the Labour Party, for God's sake, ought to be demanding, but won't, of course, is that, you know, these big corporate entities, the energy companies, the rail companies, etc., they should be taking a hit in their bottom line. And of course, what the Labour Party should be demanding is that many of these companies are brought into public ownership. I mean, the rail industry is a classic case. You know, hundreds of billions of pounds since privatisation have gone out in shareholder dividends. And now, if this was in public ownership, of course, that wouldn't be necessary. We could have, you know, lower fares, investment in our infrastructure, rail infrastructure, you know, a better system. And I was over in Sweden at the weekend for a conference about Palestinian detainees at the behest of the Israeli regime. But I used the public transport over there. I mean, and their trains are far, far, far superior to anything that, you know, that we've got. I mean, and this is about political will. I mean, you know, we just need a change of mindset. So I think, you know, in terms of the RMT's strike, they're absolutely justified. And I think it's so important that they win their struggle, because they win their struggle, hopefully, you know, that will inspire others to, you know, pick up the cudgels. You know, we need a reset in this country. It's working class people that have been paying the price for the excesses of these, you know, neoliberal corporate elites who, you know, have been dining out at our expense for the last 40 years.
Chatting to the workers, what case are they putting, do you think? What is it that the management are trying to do with them, Chris, that's, you know, causing them to say, well they want actually, to, we've got to draw a line here?
Yeah, well, they want to undermine their terms and conditions. They want to undermine their pension entitlements, etc. I mean, and you know, they've not, they're, you know, their salaries haven't kept pace with inflation. Many of them are not, you know, well paid. You know, if you consider £40,000 or £50,000 well paid, many rail workers that earn anything like that. I mean, the people I was speaking to this morning, I mean, they were talking about their salary. You know, it's around about £25,000-£26,000 a year. Now, when you're looking at fuel bills, I mean, I take my own. I mean, I live in a little house in Derby. I mean, it's an old house. Maybe that's one of the reasons why it's maybe not as insulated, perhaps, as well as it might be. But our energy bill's gone up by £1,000 a year. And it's due to go up by a similar amount in the autumn, as we know. Now, of course, the government has offered £400, you know, towards that, but that still leaves, you know, over £600 that we have to find. Now, I'm in a good position to be able to afford to do that. But if you're on a relatively modest income of 25K, as many of the RMT workers are, or for many millions of other people earning considerably less than that, I mean, that really is a catastrophe for many, many people. And so, you know, the fact that the RMT are taking this action, I think, is really important, and it's crucial that they win it, because as I've already said, that will hopefully inspire others to take action as well. We need that reset. You know, we need to redistribute income and wealth in this country to give people a fairer share. And if we were to do that, then, you know, we would be a much better country. I mean, governments should be there to serve the public need, to serve the public good, as it were, but unfortunately, you know, they're serving the interests of the corporate sector.
Like, they seem to have a better lobby than the ordinary public do.
Well, they've got lots of money, and of course, they do, and you know, you've got the media on their side. I mean, the corporate media I'm talking about, who are just a mouthpiece for the corporate elites. And they want to demoralise people and make them fearful, as it were, because, you know, that enables the status quo to prevail. And, you know, I think the RMT action today and, you know, this week will hopefully give people confidence. And, you know, certainly as and when they win, I'm hopeful that they will do, that will give people even more confidence that, you know, we workers standing together can actually make a difference. And that's the only power we've got. As working class people, the only power we really have is solidarity. And I think it's kind of getting that message across, sense of the power that we have. But we can only deploy that power when we stick together.
Yeah,
I always used to say to people, like still building the...
There's quite a lot of people looking at these strikers thinking, well, thank goodness someone is actually doing this. And, you know, everyone is talking about it, but no one's been doing it.
And that's the sense, as I say, from the reaction of motorists driving by and indeed pedestrians walking by, making that very point. Thank God somebody's making a stand at last, you know. And, you know, we need to build on that and support the RMT as best we can to ensure that, you know, they can drive home this victory. But, of course, the Tories are determined.
There is another agenda, I think, in the railways at the moment, which is a sort of complete and utter demanning and robotisation, where they're trying to say, well, we don't need ticket offices anymore. We don't need staff on trains. We're already running trains with no staff at all. And perhaps we can run the railway by remote control.
Well, I'm sure there is that's a line that some in the rail industry are taking. But, you know, as the Luddites said all those years ago, new technology should be our servant, not our master. But I'm not sure, even if you could run the railway remotely, not having that human interaction, though, you know, that sort of personal touch that you have when real people, as it were, are there to assist on the platforms, in the ticket offices, etc., on the trains themselves, it's reassuring, you know, to have that presence there. But yeah, obviously, let's use new technology where appropriate, but let's use it in a way to benefit people, to benefit the many, you know, not just to kind of, you know, increase the profits of the few.
One of the things that I noticed that you've been talking about as well recently, Chris, is this whole idea of we've got a deficit and we mustn't run a deficit. This is one of the things the government's saying we simply can't afford to do, run a deficit. And I know that you're one of the people that says, well, actually, this isn't really, strictly speaking, true. Can you just explain why it is that we can indefinitely run a deficit in Britain if we want to?
Well, never mind about not strictly speaking. It's complete nonsense to suggest that, you know, we can't run a deficit. I mean, look, you know, we've run a deficit virtually every year since, you know, for kind of 100 or 200 years or more. Look, in a country like Britain, which has its own sovereign currency, I mean, it's the government that issues the money. So we can never run out of money. Money is no object for a government. And, you know, rather than, you know, using the budget to balance the economy, which is, you know, how we're going at the moment, we should be using the economy to balance the budget, beg your pardon, again, the wrong way around, we should be using the budget to balance the economy, in other words, to create a good society. And, you know, the government should be, you know, for example, I mean, like a radical progressive socialist government could be committing to full employment, you know, investing in our infrastructure, investing in housing, a Green New Deal, improving our public services, which have, you know, been in meltdown for God knows how long. I mean, they're in a shocking state. And, you know, there's no inflationary problem by investing in the economy, so long as you're spending up to the capacity of the economy, this is the public spending, this is, the capacity of the economy to absorb that spend. Well, it's quite clear that there's massive capacity at the moment. We've got lots of people who are underemployed. We have massive needs in terms of, as I've already mentioned, you know, infrastructure improvements and so on. And so, you know, anything that's for sale in our own currency in pound sterling, I mean, you know, the government can just find the money, just, you know, create the money. I mean, that's what we saw the government do when we saw the neoliberal banking crash, which should have seen a reset but didn't. But they were quite happy to, you know, create hundreds of billions of pounds to bail out the banks through quantitative easing. And when they talk about, you know, government borrowing, that's a misnomer, you know. Because the vast bulk of so-called government borrowing is borrowing money from essentially the Bank of England. So the Bank of England creates it, provides it for the government, and the government's saying it's borrowing the money. It's nonsense. And you know, any government bonds which are bought in the, you know, the private sector is it's merely a just a kind of bookkeeping exercise in the Treasury, a few keystrokes on a keypad in the Treasury by a Treasury functionary to redeem any bonds, you know, any government bonds which is held by the private sector. So, you know, there is no real issue there. I mean, I think, as I've said, the government should be there to, you know, for the public good. It should be, you know, setting goals, if you like, mission oriented budgeting, you know, to create that good society that everybody would benefit from. And, you know, by investing in infrastructure and housing and so on, I mean, you'd be creating economic growth. You're creating jobs, as it were, for people in the country. It's just a lack of political will. And you know, people have been, you know, sold a pup, really, in relation to, you know, the economy and, you know, oh, can we afford this, that, and the other? And, you know, the economy, the British economy, is not like a household budget. And that's how it's often explained, you know, in the media and indeed by politicians. Even, you know, John McDonnell, when he was Shadow Chancellor, spoke in those terms. And that's kind of neoliberal framing. And it kind of gives the impression that, you know, somehow you need the billionaire class in order to create the good society because you need the tax revenue from the billionaires. No, you don't. I mean, when Lord Sugar said that if Corbyn came to power, he would leave the country, my response was, great, I'll drive you to the airport. We don't need the billionaire class. As far as I'm concerned, they can all bugger off. We, you know, I mean, they're a drain, frankly, on our society. And, you know, taxation isn't used to provision the government. Taxation is used to create a value for the currency, to, you know, drive behavior change, to encourage people, you know, for example, to use environmentally friendly vehicles and things like that, and to address inflation. So if the economy is overheating, they can, taxation can be used to, you know, take out some of that heat in the economy, and also where to enable, you know, if you like, to create space. So if the economy, say, is working at full tilt, but we want to have a big infrastructure program or whatever, we want a big public spending program, but there isn't the kind of, you know, spare capacity to be able to absorb that, you're going to create an inflationary pressure. So what do you do? Well, you can tax out some of that pressure by taxing the, you know, the private sector and so on to create the space for your public investment. And I just think, you know, this is kind of fairly straightforward. And what I recommend anybody, you know, listening to this is to read Stephanie Kelton's The Deficit Myth, excellent book, which actually explodes, you know, the myths and explains, you know, how the economy can work for the interests of the many, not the few, as it were. And there's another good book by Bill Mitchell, and it's called Reclaiming the State. I think it's produced, sure if it's Pluto Press that produced that, but anyway, yeah, Reclaiming the State by Bill Mitchell. That or The Deficit Myth are books which are well worth reading. And I think it's important that, you know, people get up to speed to some extent on this, because it, you know, if I think people have a better understanding of how the monetary system operates, then it prevents, you know, the media, it prevents politicians from pulling the wool over our eyes. And that's what they've been doing for...
I can remember Ian Fraser, Chris, who's a correspondent for the Glasgow Herald for a long time, a freelance finance journalist, telling me that the financial journalists, basically, if you were working as a financial journalist for one of the major papers or one of the London press or even a regional paper, that it was a career suicide to really even question some of the main tenets which you're supposed to. It's almost, I mean, what he described it as a bit of a dark art. And what you're suggesting there is, it's almost as if you're saying there's no point in paying taxes because the taxpayers' money is a fiction.
Yeah, no, there is a purpose to tax, because in order to create a value for the currency, how is that achieved? I mean, if you think about it, it's just a piece of paper or plastic, isn't it? Now, I think, you know, £5, £10, £20, £50, no good. But why does it have a value? Well, it's a value because the corporate sector that operates in this country, private individuals, then we need to acquire the currency to pay our tax liability. So it kind of creates a value for the currency. But as I've already said, it also is necessary to drive behavior change, to, you know, move towards a greener lifestyle, and sort of that can be rewarded through tax breaks and things like that. It's also necessary, again, as I've said, to address inflationary pressures, or where an economy is working at full tilt, to create space in the economy for government spending to be injected into the economy, so that, you know, you're not overheating the economy in that sense. So there is a purpose, yes, to tax, but it isn't to provision the government with the resources that it needs to pay for the things that governments do, because government is in control of the creation of the money.
Okay, well, you know, I'm going to give you Rishi Sunak's job finally, Chris. If you were him, what would you now be doing? Because we've got so many people here that talking about the cost of living crisis or disaster, whatever you want to call it, loads of people being basically driven into debt right across the country, and this being used as a tool to sort of discipline people around the whole idea of, you know, you have got to work harder, see your kids less, go on holiday less, you know, struggle to feed your kids, live in fear. What's your prescription for sorting this out? I mean, I'm talking about in a permanent fashion rather than just putting sticking plasters on, like,
and that's what we've been doing.
Bank account, which, you know, is probably spent in a few weeks.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think we need a root and branch reform of the way in which the economy operates. One of the first things to do, of course, although it isn't kind of directly the Chancellor's responsibility, I would end the war in Ukraine. I would certainly stop sending arms to Ukraine, and I'd be using, you know, Britain's good offices, as it were, to you know, bring a resolution to that conflict, because that has actually generated the spike in energy bills, food bills, and could, you know, create shortages of both in the not too distant future if we're not careful. So that's one thing. But I think in more general terms, I would introduce a job guarantee scheme, so guarantee everybody, you know, a full employment economy, and that would be something that, you know, the government would step in and provide, so that where there was an issue of unemployment emerging, well, then the state could step in through a job guarantee initiative. I'd bring all of the utilities into public ownership, including, you know, the telecommunications and things like that, so that we are actually, you know, using the, which are, you know, by and large monopolies, many of them, for the public good, so that we're not actually wasting money on, you know, paying out dividends to shareholders. We're actually, you know, ensuring that we've got the resources in those various industries to, you know, provide, you know, better, much better service, better quality of services at a reduced price, as it were. And, you know, as I say, just use the. I would be using the flexibilities at our disposal to ensure that the, you know, the resources were made available. Coming back to the point I was making a bit earlier on in our conversation, you know, have a budget that actually is used to balance the economy, rather than saying that we use the economy to balance the budget, as it were. Set goals, you know, mission oriented. Budgeting. So we kind of set out, okay, what is it we want to do in this country? Well, okay, we want to create a good society. Well, how do we do that? Well, you know, full employment. Yeah, great. Let's reduce the pension age. Let's actually reduce the working week. Don't forget, John Maynard Keynes predicted in 1930 that his grandchildren, i.e. our generation, would only working 15 hours a week because of the march of new technology, etc. Well, new technology, of course, has come. And I remember growing up in the 1960s and early 70s being told to get ready for the leisure generation, because by the time of the 1990s and early 2000s, we'd have lots more leisure time. Well, that's never come to pass. New technology has come on stream, certainly, but it's not been used for the benefit of the masses. It's been used to enrich the elites. And whilst it's true that new technology has accounted for a reduction in some of the jobs, that's true, but the biggest reason why we've seen a diminution in, you know, in some of those skilled manufacturing jobs that in the city that I used to have when I left school in 1972, around 120,000 people working in a manufacturing. It's a fraction of that now. It's about 15 or 20,000 at most. Because many of the jobs have been offshored. They've been in the globalized economy, so they've sent those jobs over to low wage economies. And so those are the sort of things I think I'd be looking to do. Use the power at our disposal for the benefit of the people, rather than, you know, as I keep saying, the benefit of the corporate elites. I mean, what we've got at the moment is socialism for the rich and penury for everybody else.
Look, I said finally, but I've got to press you on this. There's a lot of people on the left are actually supporting Putin in this war he's promulgating against Ukraine, which seems pretty mm-hmm. shocking, really.
Well, I mean, I think nobody wants war, and that war should and indeed could have been avoided. It was the NATO who, you know, were, you know, goading, provoking the war. It benefits the military-industrial complex. The US has recently agreed a £40 billion package for Ukraine that will end up in the coffers of US corporations, predominantly in the weapons industry, but also in other areas too. It's not about kind of supporting Putin otherwise, but I think it's kind of recognizing that what the genesis of this war was, and it was a US-backed coup, and then a war that was declared effectively against the East Ukraine in the Donbass region by Ukraine itself, so killing their fellow citizens, mainly Russian-speaking citizens. And just before the Russians' military operation in Ukraine began, the Ukrainian military were massing and had started an intense bombardment of Donbass. And just, I think, two or three days before, the German Chancellor Scholz was in discussions with Zelensky about, you know, avoiding conflict. And essentially that was about, you know, committing to neutrality. But I don't know whoever was pulling Zelensky's strings, whether it's the Nazis inside Ukraine and the US State Department, I don't know, but he refused to do that. And so all these people's lives have been needlessly lost, and more lives are going to be lost while ever this proxy war continues. And I think what we should be arguing for is a peace, and for the West to be demanding that their efforts are put into, the senior politicians and diplomats are put into, providing a peaceful solution. And
hang on though, Chris, because the Russians are not going to stop, are they, until they've taken over these two breakaway republics?
Well, they're not seeking to take them over, are they? I mean, they've already declared independence. Luhansk and Donetsk have already declared independence. I think if the Minsk Accords had been agreed, which were signed initially in, I think, 2014, and then a second Minsk II, as they so-called, in 2015, which stipulated ceasefire, pullback of troops, etc., recognition of some autonomy for those regions, elections, etc., for the people, then none of this would have been necessary. But of course they wouldn't they wouldn't comply with that. We'd got Poroshenko, former Ukrainian president, in a very bellicose speech saying they were going to make the children in the Donbass region cower in their basements because of the scale of the bombardment that they were going to unleash against them. So this war, in my opinion, is entirely the responsibility of the Ukrainian administration and NATO. And it could have been avoided, should have been avoided, and it needs to be ended as soon as possible. That's what we should be demanding, I think, because all of, well, I mean, obviously, you know, the terrible consequences of war and, you know, the weapons which are being sent over to there will only help to prolong it. But the sanctions are also entirely counterproductive. I mean, the you know, the aim to trash the Russian economy when they kicked them out of SWIFT, that the SWIFT banking system, totally failed. I mean, there was a small reduction in the value of the ruble initially, but now it's rallied and now it's the strongest currency in the world. I mean, this is incredible. The consequences of the sanctions are also, as we've already said, as well in this discussion, leading to a massive increase in the cost of energy and a massive increase in the cost of food. And that's only going to get worse. And we could end up with shortages. I mean, we could end up with, you know, with rationing of these things, you know, which we've taken for granted for many, many years. So it's not working by any kind of metric that you look at it. It's, you know, it's ordinary people that are in the, you know, in the West, as it were, in Europe and in Britain, that are paying the price of this.
It looks as if these sanctions may have affected Europeans and domestic population more than they have the Russians, which is unbelievable.
Well, anyway, they certainly have.
Chris Williamson, thanks very much for joining us.